I don't know.
Great. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order. Committee, we're going to start out with continuing the public hearing on 973 until such time as I may close it to move to some other bills for work sessions. And if time allows, I'll come back to 973 if there's further people to testify. But we left, if you recall, with three people signed up who had not got an opportunity to speak to Senate Bill 973, and that would be Jim Carlson, Hasina Squires, and John Powell. So with that, I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 973A. And if those three named people could approach the dais or some semblance of those three people.
Or John Powell, right there.
Victoria, would you give us a brief refresher on that bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 973A revises life settlement insurance regulations, prohibits stranger or originated life insurance practice or plan, defines parameters and reporting requirements for life settlement providers, brokers, producers, and agents, requires specified disclosures to policy owner at the time of the contract signing and to life settlement purchasers, prohibits life settlement contract for 5 years after issuance of policy with exceptions, prohibits certain solicitations and adds regulations and restrictions on advertising of life settlement contracts and related products. Grants DCBS rulemaking authority, makes a violation of Life Settlement Contracts Act an unlawful trade practice, prohibits person convicted of felony involving dishonesty or breach of trust from engaging in business of life settlements, requires persons engaged in life settlement business to inform DCBS of suspected fraud. This bill passed the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs 4-1, passed out of the Senate 27-3. You have an assortment of amendments in front of you. I believe you should have A3s, A9s, and A10s. You may have A7s and A8s, but the A10s replace the A7s and the A8s. And I'll leave it at that.
All right, thank you. And committee, don't worry too much about sorting out the amendments at this point, but because I'm not sure I've sorted through all of them yet. They have been coming out today, and I know there are some amendments replacing others, but and we'll have another opportunity to go over these amendments. So welcome to the committee this afternoon. If you identify yourself for the record, please.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Carlson, and I'm the president of the Oregon Healthcare Association. We're a not-for-profit trade association that represents about 600 licensed long-term care and senior housing and in-home care providers throughout the state, and our members provide services each day to over 40,000 Oregonians. The reason why we're interested in this bill actually relates to the fact that we've got a bit of a long-term care funding crisis in this country, not only here in Oregon where we saw co-chair's budget that was released earlier in the week, and we're making over $120 million worth of reductions in the general fund on programs serving low-income seniors and people with disabilities, but throughout the country. We care about this bill because actually I first became aware that there was even a product called a life settlement agreement first probably about a year and a half ago when I was at a national conference, and they were talking about resources that were out there to help seniors pay for the health care and services they need so folks aren't forced to impoverish themselves and go on to Medicaid and other things where they essentially become then at least a partial responsibility for the taxpayer. We have a lot of seniors that our members care for who oftentimes when they're looking to make the move into a long-term care facility, assisted living, residential care, or others, oftentimes it's the proceeds from the sale of their home that help fund that care, that transition. Data that I have seen that I would source from Milliman indicates that each year in the United States you have about $75 billion worth of life insurance that people over age 70 have policies that are allowed to lapse, about $70 billion worth of value that could be converted into life settlement agreements that could be used to help pay for the care and services that a lot of these folks require and a lot of these folks need and that they struggle with to essentially help pay for their health care costs and long-term care costs. And that was a number that caught my attention when I first became aware of this. And we have many folks who come in and enter the long-term care system who are struggling and looking for ways to pay for these services that they need. Legitimate life settlement agreements are one of those vehicles that can help them pay for that. And I agree very strongly with comments that were made by Senator Bonamici as well as by Teresa Miller at the insurance division that this legislation designed to ban STOLEs and to provide consumer protections was not intended, nor is it intended in any way, to impact or cause problems on the use of legitimate life settlement agreements. And that is our interest. I'm not here representing any insurance company or any insurance interest. Our interest is in preserving the use of legitimate life settlement agreements. We have some amendments that are going to be proposed that we support that deal with primarily three consumer disclosures. The first one would be language that's modeled on language that's in the Washington law that was passed recently that would require on disclosure information that goes out to consumer at the time a life insurance policy is about to lapse, that there would be information in there indicating that there are many options available for seniors instead of allowing that policy to lapse, including life settlement agreements, and basically urging them to talk to qualified financial advisors or others to seek more information. I think Representative Cowan indicated the other day in the hearing that she didn't even know such a thing as life settlement agreement existed, and I think a lot of consumers don't know that this kind of product exists and that it's an asset that they potentially can access to help pay for services they may need. The second consumer disclosure goes into proposed language in the bill that we had an objection to in the current language in the bill that reads, and these are on page 11, lines 5 to 7, section 11, sub 1E. The current language
Can you repeat that, sir?
I'm sorry. Yes. Pages 11, lines 5 to 7, section 11, subsection 1E. The current language reads, receipt of the proceeds of a life settlement may adversely affect the owner's eligibility for Medicaid or other government benefits or entitlements, and advice should be obtained from the appropriate government agencies. Now, we know through work that we've done locally and with our National Association and others that about 70% of all Americans confuse what Medicaid and Medicare are. They don't even know the differences. That language, we think, would cause alarm and concern for people that, oh, I may no longer qualify for Medicaid. Well, fact of the matter is what that means is you would have assets available to pay for your care and your services, and you would not be forced to impoverish yourself in order to get the care and services that you need. And so we have suggested language that would, we think, more fully describe to the consumer what their options are in such a circumstance. And we have suggested language that's part of the Dash 7 amendments that would read the same on the first part, that receipt of proceeds from a life settlement contract may affect the owner's eligibility for public assistance or other government benefits or entitlements, and that advice should be obtained from the appropriate agencies. We would then add that receipt of proceeds from a life settlement contract may reduce the owner's risk of becoming impoverished and becoming dependent on public assistance or other government benefits or entitlements. And we believe that's important information to give a consumer both sides of the story, that that actually getting the proceeds of one of these contracts could help them stay off government assistance, which I think is really aligned with taxpayers' issues and concerns also, particularly when we're dealing with a budget crisis like we are right now here in Oregon and many other states around the country. And then the third and final suggested language we have would be just primarily to add some language that would allow disclosure of financial self-interest in these agreements. And in the Dash 7, and I believe Ms. Squires is going to speak to this specifically, we've got some further financial disclosure language we believe should be in there for consumers, just so that we're making sure that consumers are getting the maximum value if they decide to sell a life insurance policy, that they're not essentially just loading these policies up with huge commissions to other folks and reducing the size of the value of that asset to the senior. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome, and we'll go ahead and hear your testimony. If you have anything that's repetitive, of course, we don't need to hear that, but introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of Life Settlement Financial. I appreciate your upfrontness with the repetition and redundancy of Mr. Carlson's testimony. He actually went through most of our amendments, so I'll be as brief as possible, since I know you have a full agenda, and I know some of your committee members would probably not appreciate having to stay here till 6 p.m. tonight. So I do represent Life Financial Settlement Company, and we are a legitimate life financial settlement in the business of life financial settlements. They are highly regulated, and as Mr. Carlson has indicated, we're here to support the Dash 7 amendments. I want to be very clear that our company does not use brokers, and so the section of the amendment that would be of the A7 amendment, lines 10 through, flipping over to the other page, that second section of the amendment is something that we specifically requested. Our company doesn't employ brokers. We employ full-time salaried people who, when they're conducting and transacting this business, they don't have any incentive to sell policies, that it is their full-time employment. So without being repetitive, I do want to just highlight a couple of things in our amendment, in the Dash 7 amendment. It appears just from discussions that the first two sections of our A7 amendment are not going to be controversial with respect to other parties. The third section will be the most controversial and probably will have a little bit of opposition. So I do want to highlight why it is that we have requested that section of the amendment. So this would be on page 2 of the A7 amendments. And what we did was try to mirror language that was recently passed in the Washington statute. And this gets specifically, as Mr. Carlson indicated, to Representative Callan's concern that people may not know that this is an option out there. So what we're after here and what we're looking for is increased disclosure requirements for life insurance companies to disclose that life settlement agreements are viable alternatives to letting insurance policies lapse. That's something that a lot of consumers don't know about. We think this is an additional increased consumer protection, that other options actually do exist, and you actually have the right to shop around and get advice from different financial advisors. So we think that's an increased consumer protection piece that should be in the final product of this bill as it moves forward, and that's why we've included it in the A7 amendments. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Powell, you want to go
ahead? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Powell, representing the Standard Insurance Company, headquartered in Portland, Oregon, and State Farm Insurance Companies. Mr. Chairman, members, we support Senate Bill 973 with the DCBS amendments only. We do think that much to-do has been made about the issue of 5 years versus 2 years, and again, my testimony, I just simply want to reiterate, for people purchasing life insurance themselves, in the normal course of business, this does not affect their ability to sell this policy after that two-year period has run. If you look on page 17 of the bill, the only time that five-year kicks in is when somebody, for example, is paying the premiums on behalf of this person who has no insurable interest in them. And that's the STOLI issue. So the bill is carefully crafted to leave your insurance policy alone if you're buying it for the right reasons. And I do believe that all of the other settlement issues and notice issues could be dealt with in another forum, in another bill, if we want to take on just the issue of settlements. That's been an issue in the building. There's been legislation passed in the past and could be passed with more notification and other issues in it. So we would urge you to pass the bill in its current form with the DCBS amendments.
And for clarification, now you're referring to the A8 amendments.
Yes.
Questions from the committee?
Questions.
Representative Callan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Powell, I guess I'm just trying to figure out what would be the problem with the Dash 7s from your perspective.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Cowan, there are not necessarily, as the witness pointed out, there's not necessarily a problem with some of the disclosure information in the Dash 7 amendments. We do have concerns over, currently when a policy is going to lapse, your insurance company does notify you, and they're required to notify you by law. So, again, we don't, in the case of a settlement, there is either a broker available or a full-time salaried person available working with these people. And they, so in terms of explaining to that party what a settlement is, that party is going to have full access to those people. And we just see amending this bill now with new notification amendments is simply going to delay its passage.
Follow up. So you object to the broker language?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Cowan, I'm not sure which part of it you're referring to.
For clarification, I thought I heard in the testimony, you had mentioned broker, and I thought I had heard in the testimony something about not utilizing brokers and basing decisions on commissions and some things like
Mr.
that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cowan, I believe the testimony was that some companies use salaried employees as opposed to contracting with brokers. And in either case, they're representing the settlement company.
Right. So that's not the objectionable language. It's just that you don't think there's been enough discussion. Okay, I'm just trying to understand. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, quick question for you. Is this something insurance companies could handle in the language of their life insurance policies rather than having to pass legislation to deal with this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagner, no. It would have to be, I think, a matter of statutory guidance.
Follow up.
When you do a life insurance policy, isn't an agreement between you and the person buying the policy? So if the language is in the policy, they would realize, okay, I can't do this with this policy.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Whitener, again, there would be, I don't know that the department would approve a life insurance form with this language in it without a statutory basis.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony and kind of wrapping up our carryover from the other day. Certainly we have a lot of amendments before this committee, and this bill I actually have scheduled again for Friday. So I appreciate your testimony on it. And at this point, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 973A.
Thank you.
So with that, I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 731. Victoria, would you give us a brief description of Senate Bill 731?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 731A protects amount in garnishee's financial account that is equal to the lesser of amount of certain direct deposit or electronic transfer exempt funds deposited in calendar month preceding delivery of writ of garnishment or total balance in account. Specifies funds exempt from garnishment. Specifies that protection applies when financial institution can readily identify qualifying exempt funds or when account holder formerly identifies qualifying exempt funds. Specifies first in, first out as accounting method to be used when identifying exempt funds. Prohibits financial institution from charging processing fee if debtor's deposited funds are not subject to garnishment. Increases garnishment search fee paid to financial institution from $10 to $15 exempts Department of Revenue from search fee increase. Releases financial institution from liability if institution acts in good faith when determining whether funds are subject to garnishment. This bill passed out of the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs unanimously and passed the Senate unanimously. I believe that you have dash A9 and dash A10 amendments in front of you.
Thank you. And up first, I'd like to have Senator Bonamici, and welcome to our committee this afternoon.
Thank you, Chair Hovey. I'm sorry if I was presumptuous by coming up here.
You certainly were not. I also wanted to check with you. I know you're in another committee, and I know you want to testify on a couple of bills, so we can either take all your testimony, all three bills, one after another.
I appreciate that, Chair Holden.
Or you can stay and enjoy the committee, whatever you want.
I'll testify in this, and then I'll go back to the other committee, and then when you get to the other bills, I'll come back, and then I'll do the same thing, and then I'll come back again. Thank you.
I haven't quite figured out
the cloning thing yet.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. I'm Suzanne Bonamici. I represent Senate District 17, which is in Washington County, Multnomah County. And I'm here in strong support of Senate Bill 731A, which, as your committee administrator explained, passed out of the committee and the Senate floor unanimously. And here's what happened. This bill is really addressing a predicament in the current law regarding exempt funds. And the purpose of public benefits, things like veterans benefits, Social Security, disability, are to create a safety net for seniors, veterans, people with disabilities, vulnerable citizens to meet their basic needs. And those funds are exempt from collection under both state and federal law, meaning they're protected. And what happens under the current statutes is the exempt funds are typically deposited by electronic transfer into the recipient's bank account, and in fact the government agencies are encouraging that for security reasons to have that electronic transfer. And then if a bank or a credit union, if a financial institution receives a garnishment order from a creditor, the financial institution must follow that order. They don't have any choice. They have to turn over the funds, even if they know that the funds are exempt. And then under the current law, the way the process is set up is that the recipient, now we're talking about a senior citizen, a disabled veteran, it's up to that person to go file something called a claim of exemption, challenge the turnover of the funds, and reverse the transaction. But in the meantime, they don't have the money that they need to meet their basic needs, pay their rent, pay their medical bills, buy food. So that process can also take a significant amount of time. In fact, in the committee on the Senate side, we heard about an Oregon veteran who had his veterans benefits garnished, exempt benefits. He had the assistance of an attorney because I believe he went to the Oregon Law Center, and they were trying to help him with that claim of exemption process. And it had been weeks, I think it was about 6 weeks, and he still didn't have the money back yet. So it's very difficult for these people to meet their needs during that period of time. So they're left without the funds that they need. So when we found out about this issue, there was a work group. People got together and started talking about how we could resolve this situation. And I really want to thank everyone involved. All the interested parties came together. The Oregon bankers came right back with a proposal. The collection industry, they came back and worked on this. But I particularly want to thank Senator Girod from the Senate committee because he really worked hard to make sure that we had a proposal that worked. So here's what we ended up with. When a person receives a direct deposit of exempt funds, each month, that amount equal to that recipient's amount of exempt benefits is protected from garnishment if the funds are either readily identifiable or if the recipient fills out a form, like an affidavit identifying the funds. And this can be completed at the time the account is open or at a later date. And so this protection applies to direct deposits that are identified in the bill, Social Security, veterans benefits, public assistance, unemployment, black lung benefits, and workers' compensation. And so the way this works now is it's fair to the institutions and the creditors because it's pretty straightforward. The financial institution simply has to look to see if the funds are readily identifiable as exempt funds or if there's the affidavit on file. they don't need to turn over the funds. In fact, in the Senate committee, there was one financial institution where somebody testified that sometimes they don't actually turn over the funds when they know they're exempt. I hope nobody goes back and checks that tape and follows up on that. But this would simply put that process into law, that if they can say, these funds are exempt, we don't need to turn them over, it saves the recipient from having to go challenge that through a claim of exemption. So the one important part, too, is that the financial institutions have a complete release of liability for good faith application of the law. So, for example, if they see funds and they determine that they're readily identifiable, and so they don't turn them over, and that was a mistake, there's no liability. Or, contrarily, if they turn them over because they think that they're not exempt and they turn out to be exempt, they still have complete release from liability, because we wanted to make this workable for everyone concerned. Again, in amounts over the amount that's exempt can still be garnished. So say, for example, there's a veteran who's getting $750 a month, for example, in veterans benefits, and that's the amount that's exempt. If there's amount over that, that can still be garnished. As part of the compromise in negotiating this bill, the financial institutions will receive, instead of the $10 fee now for garnishment, $15. So that's to accommodate the additional work that the financial institutions will receive. The one exception is if it's the Department of State, Department of Revenue, then they continue to pay the existing $10. And also want to point out that that fee is ultimately recoverable from the debtor. So, Mr. Chair and Committee, this bill is based on models that are working in other states. Several states have chosen the approach of just taking a flat amount per month, for example, $1,700 or $2,500 if somebody receives exempt funds. Some states have taken that approach and said that amount is protected no matter what, and that you can't garnish below that amount. We decided not to take that amount, because there was a concern raised that under that approach there would still be the possibility that some exempt funds would be garnished. I want to point out that we had letters of support from the AARP, Disability Rights Oregon, Oregon War Veterans Association, Oregon Law Center, and Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center. Chair Holvey and committee members, I believe that this is a very important bill to protect that the citizens in Oregon who are the recipients of those benefits that are exempt under law. This doesn't change what is exempt or the even the amount that's exempt. It protects those exempt funds from being garnished and requiring the recipient to go or reverse that transaction and in the meantime not have the funds they need to meet their basic needs. So thank you very much for having a hearing on Senate Bill 731A, and I encourage you to send this bill to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and I will be happy to entertain questions.
Sure. Representative Krieger.
If this benefit was like a $500 benefit at the end of the month, they hadn't spent all that $500. Let's say they were going to put $50 or $100 away a month for their taxes, property taxes, at the end of the year. Then the next check comes in. Would that be subject to garnishment, the stuff they left in there, when it originally was from a source that was not garnishable?
If it's a
The first check is $500. Which is exempt from garnishment. They keep $100 in the bank. They spend $400, and before the next check comes, and $100 is left in that account from the original non-garnishable dollars. Now they got another $500 in there. Does that $100 become garnishable?
Not if it's readily identifiable.
So they could build value of non-garnishable dollars for an operation they have to have, or new tires on the car they could save for?
Well, the funds are exempt. Sybil might be able to answer that question for me. She understands the technical part of it more than I do. Thank
I'd you. Like to call up Sybil Hebb.
Why, thank you.
Here, come out.
Chair Holvey, excuse me.
No, please. Back me up.
Senator Bennett, Chair Holvey and members of the committee, Representative Krieger, I appreciate the question. And the bill is set up such that... My name is Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, also in support of Senate Bill 731. And the bill is set up such that the bank will take a snapshot look at one calendar month's deposits of exempt funds. And so you're correct, if there are other funds that were originally from exempt sources that are in the account, those could be subject to garnishment. They would still be protected under our exemption laws, and they would still be something that they could, that the account holder could get back through the court process. So they would still be entitled to what is the current process by which they can get exempt funds back. But the bill provides immediate protection up front for 1 month's worth of benefits. If that answers your question.
Follow up?
Well, maybe. I would hope that not every senior or person that's receiving benefits is living that close check to check. And there's now, you know, there might be 25 a month or 50 that they want to carry forward for, like I said, an operation, new tires, paying their insurance. It would seem to me like if it came from an exempt fund to start with, it'll stay that way no matter where it is through time.
And Chair Hovey, Representative Krieger, there would still be the ability to raise that claim, but it would be at the court process. Yes, it would be through different process. And so the bill provides some immediate and immediately applicable protection to 1 month's worth, so at least people aren't in a position in which they can't buy the gas to get to the courthouse to go through the process.
Okay. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on that, it seems to me that if there's commingled funds in an account, it becomes extremely difficult to isolate and say these are exempt funds. How do we deal with that?
Chair Hovey and Representative Riley, that's why there is the policy choice of having a set amount per month that's immediately free from being turned over
and
protected.
And I would add that if there is other money that the debtor or the account holder would like to claim as exempt, then they can go to the court process where there is the time to go through that first in, first out analysis. At the bank account level, we wouldn't expect the banks to do that.
Right. And Chair Hovey and Representative Riley, you realize under current law, it all gets turned over, the total amount, even if it is exempt.
Thank you. A question about the form. We have a -9 amendment has been submitted to us that appears, I think, to remove some portion of this bill. I don't know if you have seen that amendment.
Chair Hovey, I haven't actually seen the amendment, but I heard about the amendment. My concern with that, Chair Hovey and committee members, is that then the only way to protect the funds would be if they're readily identifiable. And because of the complete release of liability, I would be concerned that there may be too many institutions that erred on the side of saying, well, we can't identify these, so we're going to turn them over. So the affidavit is a way for the customer, the recipient of the funds, to say, these are the funds that are exempt. There was a discussion about having the sender of the funds identify them. And Chair Hovey and committee, if we could get the Veterans Administration or the Social Security Administration to do that, we would have considered that. But I think that's sort of beyond what we're capable of doing from here in Salem. So we saw the affidavit as a way for the customer to identify the funds. So it's an either or now. Either it's identified by the customer or they're readily identifiable.
And so you mentioned some liability issues to the financial institutions. They're
not liable if they turn, Mr. Chair, and committee members, there is no liability if they turn over the funds and they turn out to be exempt, or if they don't turn over the funds and they aren't exempt. So we designed that because we understand that this is sort of a new thing that the financial institutions will be undertaking. So I would be concerned that if the customer can't fill out that form identifying, all there would be is the readily identifiable standard, and I'd just be concerned that there might be too much inclination, and I know I'm not questioning the intent of the financial institutions. They've worked really hard on this bill, but there may be some who say, well, we can't readily identify these, so we're just going to turn them over. So I see the affidavit as sort of an extra protection for the customer.
Thank you. And so with the form, then, that you still have the need to have readily identifiable, because some people may not know to turn into a form, I'm guessing. So it's an either-or.
Right. Chair Hovey, I think Sybil or somebody from Disability Rights Oregon could testify about some of the Oregonians. This is designed to protect disabled people, seniors. It may be difficult for them to get in and know that they need to fill out the form and to fill out the form. And so this gives the protection if the financial institution can identify. Some of the funds, is my understanding, are readily identifiable as exempt. As some of the financial institutions testified in the committee, they can tell with some of these, they can tell from looking at them by the source or by the nature of the funds.
Okay. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Sybil was in the work group, and I'm not sure if you were a senator or not, but was it discussed having a separate account in the work group at all? Because I think, to me, it seems almost like the easiest way to do it, to set up an account where only those funds go into that account and nobody can touch those except for the person receiving them.
Chair Hovey and Vice Chair Widener, to say your name right. That was discussed. We were concerned about additional fees that may be involved and the difficulty of having people come in and set up a separate account and paying the fees for that account. And as I explained, there are several other states who are doing this, and it's my understanding that no one has taken that approach. But we did discuss it. Yes.
Thank you. I know you have another committee to get back to.
I do, Chair Hovey.
And since Sybil Hebb is up, well, I think I'm going to take her testimony.
Yes.
Representative Krieger has one more question for you.
I just wanted to thank you for the three of us who received those benefits.
Chair Hovey and Representative Krieger, you're welcome. Thank you. I'll be back.
Thank you, Senator.
Does that mean there are three votes?
Do we know what hearing room she's in?
Yeah, there are three. That means there are three yes votes over here.
Sybil, if you wouldn't mind identifying yourself for the record and give us your testimony. You're a little out of order, but so am I.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center in support of Senate Bill 731. And before I give my other remarks, I did want to just follow up on Representative Widener's question about the issue of separate accounts. The Senator is correct that we were concerned about the fees that would be incurred in requiring that, but also many of the recipients of disability benefits, for example, have either physical or cognitive disabilities. And if you have, it sort of becomes an accounting challenge for people to put different checks from different accounts together in order to pay their rent, or sort of it's something that is a burden for them that we feel they would have a hard time managing. So it was the fees as well as just the accounting difficulties that would arise. So that's why we chose not to go down that road. So I did want to speak about the larger purpose of the bill a little bit, although I think the Senator did just a great job of summarizing the principles, so I'll be very short in those comments. I think I'll just offer that in these times especially, many of our clients are forced, and many Oregonians are forced, to rely more and more on the public assistance safety net that our state and federal governments have set up for vulnerable people and for people facing difficult times. And right now, more than ever, is when they need the stability of those benefits. And the fact that those benefits provide a safety net is why they have been determined to be exempt under state and federal law from collection. And that exemption law has been the case for many, many years. And so the purpose of this bill is to make sure that we are doing a better job in Oregon of actually acting in accordance with the federal exemption laws and making sure that those benefits and that the value of those benefits go to their intended recipients and help address the stability issues for which they were initially created. So that's the larger purpose of the bill. I did want to share some more detail about the client of ours, whom Senator Bonamici referred to. We had an elderly man, Vietnam War veteran, who has been very interested in this bill and has been following it from behind the scenes. He still does suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder and did not feel comfortable coming to testify, but I've been having dialogue going along. This is a gentleman who signed up, enlisted in the Vietnam War when he was 18. Right before his 19th birthday is when he was injured seriously. He spent about 6 months actually in the service and something like 19 months in the hospital, and has been completely 100% disabled ever since. And his income, his sole source of income, is veterans' disability benefits. He's now in his mid-70s. He is struggling to hang on to his home and to support himself. He was recently garnished for $2,126. That his benefit, because he is 100% disabled, his benefit is actually slightly more than that, but he had spent some of that money. So his account was wiped out to zero, essentially, by this garnishment. He made it into our office. We helped him. We realized that his funds were exempt and that he had a claim of exemption, a right to a claim of exemption. We helped him get to court. We called the creditor and said, hey, these are exempt funds. You may not have known, and we were going to file a claim of exemption. The creditor in this case actually agreed and said, you know, we recognize that they are in fact exempt, and so we release our claim. But the claim of exemption had already been filed. The garnishment had already been filed. The court was involved. There was no way for that money to get released by the court until we went through the process, which took more than 6 weeks. During this time, he was missing his utility payments. He missed his mortgage payment. He was worried about keeping the lights on. And so he's suffering significant stress. And this is just a clear example of a case in which the process that we have currently just simply doesn't work. And so that's why we're here. We have numerous stories that are similar to that. I believe you have a letter from a gentleman in Coos County who chose to write to the committee about a similar example. In his case, it was a medical debt that was owed to a hospital for an injury that resulted in his need for the disability benefits that were exempt. And so the disability benefits were garnished as a result of this bill from the hospital. And he also, similarly to our Vietnam War vet client, suffered or was charged a number of bounced check fees and garnishment fees during the waiting period. So even after they got their money back through the claim of exemption process, they were not made whole because those fees had been taken out. So that's why we're here. I did want to speak specifically to a couple of the questions that have been raised about the amendments. The dash nines, the ones that remove the affidavit form, are of importance to us for a number of reasons. Number one, the forms or the dollars that we are hoping to protect are the seven types of exempt benefits. Generally speaking, those will be easy to identify for banks. And if I may, I have an example of a printout from an account that I'd like to show the committee. And because I came charging up here without permission earlier, I didn't hand my testimony. So, generally speaking, benefits are fairly easy to identify. And as you will see from the document that's being passed around, if they're coming, they're generally coming at the same time of the month. They're coming from the Veterans Administration, or they're coming from the Social Security Administration, or from the Department of the Treasury. And they are showing up in accounts listed, identified specifically as Veterans Administration, Veterans Benefits. U.S. Social Security Administration, Supplemental Social Security. And it's easy to tell what those dollars are, what those benefits are. In that circumstance, the bill would require, when it's easy to readily identify that those funds are exempt funds of the kind that are named in the bill, then they ought to be protected. But there are some times when it may not be quite as easy. For example, if the benefit is not coded as easily, or if, for example, workers' compensation benefits, they're coming from the Safe Corps. Probably pretty easy to tell what they are. That may be that some private compensation companies will not be as easily identified. And so in that case, we want to be able to have the bank account holder be able to file an affidavit, which is a sworn statement, with the court, indicating that these benefits are one of the forms, one of the benefits that are exempt under the law. So the affidavit not only helps to identify funds that might not otherwise be as easy to identify, but it also helps, even in cases where there are readily identifiable funds, it helps to flag the account for the bank. It makes it easier and more likely that the protection will be implemented. And so that's why the affidavit is important to us. We don't want to require the affidavit of all accounts because there are some circumstances in which account holders with either cognitive or physical disabilities or barriers of one sort may not be able to get to the bank or may not know that they have the ability to file an affidavit. But we do think that it is a useful tool to help further and better implement the policy of the bill. So that's why we would not support the Dash 9 amendments. I did also want to speak to the Dash 10 amendments. We also oppose the Dash 10 amendments, which would change the way in which the bank's obligation is written. We have in the bill requested or proposed that the banks apply the protection if the funds are readily identifiable, and the Dash 10s would mean would say that. That the requirement would only be triggered if the benefits have been identified by the sender, and that's just simply not something that we think that the state can do, and we think that that would unnecessarily limit the coverage of the bill. Again, we're trying to implement a practical procedure by which we're going to do a better job of effectuating the current exemption laws. So we're trying to come up with a policy that works. And as a way to make it easier for the banks, we have not only released them completely from any liability, as long as they're acting in good faith, we have also added a $5 increased fee in the garnishment processing procedure that to recognize the fact that there may be some paperwork involved here. So for those two reasons, we would oppose the Dash 9s and the Dash 10s, and we urge your support of the engrossed bill from the Senate. I also would just add that we did have testimony on the Senate side from General Mike Caldwell as well as Paul Evans from the perspective of the Veterans Administration, and we appreciate that. There's written testimony from Disability Rights Oregon that I will pass in. They were not able to be here today because Bob Junedef is in Washington, D.C. So with that, I'll answer any questions, and I appreciate your attention.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I hadn't actually seen the Dash 10, so I was going to say it was pretty easy to oppose them. But I appreciate your testimony. And Representative Matthews, a question. I've got a pretty long list, so I'm going to try to keep the questions to a minimum. But Representative Matthews. Thank you.
Ms. Hebb, I'm just curious. Can somebody have their account garnished for failure to pay child support?
Chair Holvey, Representative Matthews, that's a great question, and I appreciate the question. I should have mentioned that we worked significantly with the Department of Justice and the Division of Child Support to look at this bill. They initially had concerns about our proposal as it was drafted. It was overbroad. The narrowing of the bill so that it's only protecting the amount of the direct deposit that was put into the account in the month previous to the acceptance of the garnishment took care of their concerns. Generally speaking, child support, instead of garnishing a bank account, will actually go directly to the source of the funds. So, for example, they can do an intercept from the Social Security Administration. That's a much better way for them because they get it every month. They don't have to do it once, you know, just sort of make a wild shot at it. They get it every month from a benefit that they know they're receiving. So they're okay with the bill. Does that answer your question?
No, absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony on this bill. Next up, speaking of war veterans, I'm going to like to call up Greg Warnock and Graham Trainer. Not that you're necessarily war veterans, but maybe you are.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Greg Warnock, the director of Oregon War Veterans Association. I'm here today with a migraine, so forgive me if I'm not as articulate as I am sometimes.
By all means, make it short.
I will.
Not hurt our feelings at all, but I appreciate you making a statement.
We have spent tens of thousands of dollars over the last several years helping veterans who've been caught by garnishment of their exempted funds. And because we've worked directly with those families, those individuals, and their caregivers, we definitely support this legislation. We've given a lot of testimony with regard to it, and you can read that from the Senate side. We also oppose, though, the additional amendments, and I wanted to make that really clear. The parties worked very hard and had a good understanding on the Senate side that this is the package that was going to come over. Additional amendments to us are kind of surprising. In addition to that, just want you to know, we took a harder line to this and actually proposed an amendment that would have fined the people that did this knowingly a $10,000 fine. And we pulled back from our amendment and knew that the compromises were good enough to bring to the House. And so we don't support any additional amendment. We'd like to see this bill move along as quickly as possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If you could introduce yourself for the record and give us a nice, short, concise testimony.
Great. Thanks, Chair Hovey and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Graham Traynor, representing the Oregon AFL-CIO, who represents over 225,000 working Oregonians. The Oregon AFL-CIO is fully in support of the SB 731 A and Gross version of the bill as written, and we've been supportive throughout the process in the Senate. We're very concerned about protecting Oregon's most vulnerable, and with Oregon's unemployment rate at over 12% and some of our affiliates seeing 30 and 40% unemployment rates, we feel it's very important that we work compassionately to protect Oregon's most vulnerable, and feel that these exempt state and federal funds must remain safe. In addition to previous testimony, I would want to, you know, on the record make it clear that we would oppose the Dash 9 amendments, and feel that it's very important that in addition to the funds being readily identifiable, that in order to make it easier for the banks to apply this protection, we feel that the recipient should fill out these affidavits to identify these funds that are not readily identifiable. And I can conclude there. So thanks for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Representative Burton, question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for you or for perhaps anyone. Just taking a step back, and I hate to do this. This is actually going to be kind of an annoying question, but I want to question the purpose of this bill again. And so clearly there are sources of wages, as defined as the term used in the statute, which are exempt. But forget about wherever the sources come from. There is a certain statutory minimum threshold which is not subject to garnishment. It's currently $183 per week, $366 per two-week period, regardless of whether that's income, whether it be benefits from whatever source derived. And given that, I mean, and we do that for to achieve the same purpose that this bill is designed to achieve. And I'm reading now from the, so that the person can pay rent, for example, pay gas to make the credit. Given that we already have that protection in place, what is the purpose of this bill?
I don't know that I would be the most appropriate.
Sorry, I came to the question a bit late.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony today.
No problem.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
If you'd reintroduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center for 731. And Representative Barton, to answer your question, there is an exemption for wages, of course, and I think there are sort of two responses that I have. Number one, not everybody works, right? So, and of course, many of the benefits that are identified in this fund, in this bill, are people who are not working. So there are different categories of people who are protected by those exemptions. But then the other distinction that's important to make is that there's a distinction to be made between things that are exempt from collection and things that are protected from garnishment. So the things that are exempt from collection are a long list of things,
right?
Wages, the seven benefits that we've identified in the bill, other benefits. There are lots of things that are exempt. What we're saying is that of those exemptions, all of which you can now currently raise through a claim of exemption process in the court proceeding, there are some that are so important that they should be protected, and they're so easy to identify, that they ought to be protected at the bank account level so that people get that effectuated protection immediately rather than having to lose the money and then go to court and say, oh, but those were my wages and I'm entitled to $183% of, or $183 a week of those, or oh, but those were my benefits, and I'm, because that process takes too long and it's not helpful to vulnerable people who are receiving the kinds of benefits that we're identifying in the bill. Does that answer your question?
So, Mr. Chair, is there your intention to remove this bill today? So otherwise, I'll just follow up with her later because I have a number of more questions. Unless you have a strong preference in moving this bill today, I can ask a few follow-ups.
If it's possible, we'd be moving the bill today. So if you have another follow-up, go ahead.
Yeah, I might. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hebb, so isn't really the relevant thing that we need to protect is a certain minimum amount in which to live? That is the relevant, not necessarily the source of the funds, but i.e. the minimum existence of funds.
Well, we, Representative Chair Holvey, Representative Barton, we love that idea, and that would be great. But I think that and that was something that was the bill as it initially started out was looked more like that, mm-hmm. Because it basically said if there were exempt funds coming into an account, then we can say these are vulnerable people. We ought to protect a basic minimum level of dollars in their account, but that would have overprotected some dollars that may not have been technically exempt. This bill is a reduced version of the bill that we started out with. We think that it provides substantial and immediately applicable protection for vulnerable people, and so we want it to move forward for that reason. It could be more protective by establishing a minimum level of money in all bank accounts for people who get direct deposit accounts or for everybody. But that's not a policy decision that that we were moving forward with or that the Senate was willing to engage in.
Chair, I just note that I don't necessarily know if this is more or less protective. It so much as like any, I suppose, bright line, it is at times more protective and at times less protective, depending on the amount of exempt benefits received relative to what the statutory minimum $183 per week is.
Chair Holvey, I think there's still some confusion. The $183 a week is only for wages.
True.
And so that only applies to a certain category of people. This bill applies to a different category of people, and it applies only to direct to those seven exempt deposits.
One last follow-up, Mr. Chair. It depends on the definition of wages being used, because when I look at ORS 18-375-385, it talks about wages. I'm just wondering if the definition of wages is purely in an employment context or if it means something broader to include these kind of benefit payments.
I believe it means wages in the employment context. Mr. Corr.
I'm ready to move on, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Thank you for indulging me.
You betcha. Don't see any other questions. I'm going to call up our next panel. Thank you,
Ms. Hebb. Thank you,
Ms. Hebb. Maybe you shouldn't go too far, though. next up, I'd like to have Pam Levitt and Janet Jocelyn.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I'm Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. Here with me today is Janet Jocelyn, our Director of Compliance, who advises credit unions on garnishment laws. So I thought I'd bring an expert on this very complex issue. You have our written testimony. We are here today to support the Dash 10 Amendment, and we'll get to the background on that rationale. We were happy to participate in the work group on the Senate side and acknowledge the accomplishments of the proponents of the bill and Senator Bonamici and Senator Girard who worked hard on it. I want you to know that we did bring up our issue on the Senate side, and in discussions we certainly wanted to support moving the bill along. So I did want you to know that our concern that I'm raising today, we did bring it up over on the Senate side. Credit unions certainly support the concepts of the bill. We're working hard right now, as you know, with all of our members who are certainly down on their luck, lost their jobs. We certainly want to protect those lower-income individuals who are living paycheck by paycheck. Our concern, specifically in the Dash 10 amendment, addresses that. You've heard the term readily identify several times in this hearing. And I think that it's interesting that a lot of those who don't work in financial institutions think that it's very easy to readily identify these payments. And according to my members, at least in talking with some of them, they have great concerns about being able to readily identify all of these funds. I think there's some very obvious ones. Social Security comes through and some retirement funds. There absolutely are some garnished funds or some funds that exempt funds that are readily identified, that can be readily identified. But I'm here today to just bring up some of those that may not be. I attached to my testimony an example. If you look under the section that's circled where it says 220, those two lines are something that a credit union might see. 522 DOG Treasury 220. It's what we're calling the sample company batch header recorder with identifying information of the transmitted check. So if you look under 220, if you go to the next page under 220, those are veterans benefits. Half of those up to prior to federal salary, half of those are exempt funds. The other half, from federal salary down, are non-exempt funds. So the credit union or financial institution would see DOG Treasury 220, and that's the indicator. That's what we're supposed to readily identify. But as you can tell, as we showed you, and Janet's going to talk a little bit more about this, there are some within that those numbers that are exempt and some that are non-exempt. Now, I know that we've been told that the bill has a complete release for financial institutions from liability for good faith application of the law, and we really appreciate that language in the bill. We think that's important. But we think it's important to make the bill right. Our members, at least in talking to my credit unions who are in credit unions every day seeing these garnishments come through, they don't want to rely on the good faith portion of this law. They want to make it right. We proposed in working with Representative Gilliam the Dash 10 amendment. We're not stuck to this language, but it's an idea for conversation. And it says a payment that a financial institution can identify as being one of the types of payments described in section subsection 2 of this section from information transmitted to the financial institution. What basically we're saying is when the transmittal comes in, we're going to be able to tell that that is an exempt fund, and we want to at least have that ability to have that language in the law. I'll let Janet talk briefly about some more specifics.
Briefly, the key word. For the record, Janet Jocelyn from the Credit Union Association of Oregon, and thank you for allowing some testimony on this item, and also appreciate working with the work group and that whole process. Our intent, again, is for to come to an agreement on some language that will be clear and concise. Clear and concise is a term that's readily recognized by anyone in the compliance world, because we deal with clear and concise disclosures all the time. So what we want, again, like as Pam said, we don't want to rely on a safe harbor. We want to do it right the first time. And readily identifiable to whom? By whose standards is something going to be readily identifiable? And so we think there's benefit in further defining that, again, in whatever language that can be agreed upon to somehow leave room to identify what that is. And I think we need to some degree, look at what accompanies that particular payment. The account history, I guess I would refer to it, that Sybil presented was something that I shared with Senator Bonamici's work group during that particular process. This identifies, to some degree, a payment, ICH payment, that would be readily identifiable. You might look at that and say, yes, that is U.S. Treasury. Supplemental security, that would be exempt money, exempt from garnishment. This happens to be one of our smallest credit unions, one of our tiniest credit unions, and what we're looking at is a snapshot of what anyone processing a garnishment at the credit union would be looking at. This would be front office, normally on the computer screen. This is what they would be looking at. There is no regulatory requirement of what the credit union displays on this. This is kind of for the credit union's eyes only. What it typically drives this is what the data processor actually feeds into this particular point. Now, there is something, as Pam pointed out, on the Treasury side, there is a supplemental record that accompanies direct deposits that identifies to a larger degree what this particular payment is, but the person who's processing that garnishment in front of the computer screen looking at this kind of a record, they're going to have that information. That's going to be back office information, and those two areas typically don't talk. So from the person looking at this particular screen trying to determine is this exempt money or not, they're not, in some cases, going to have as much information as is indicated here. Now, the other issue I'd like to point out, on that particular deposit, if we talk about a prudent person would look at this, and would you be able to identify that as exempt money? If you notice, it's referred to as an ATM, ACH deposit. This, again, happens to be a small credit union. They have very few options as to how to post something. So was this a deposit that was made at the ATM, or was this a deposit that was made by ACH? That particular credit union may not be able to look at this and say, gee, I don't know if this is, can I readily identify that this was an ACH deposit that's exempt, or a deposit made at the ATM, which wouldn't be exempt. So just kind of sharing some of the gray area that's going to accompany this particular process, and again, wanting to comply at the front end and not be able to rely on safe harbors, but be able to comply fully and having some language that would help us to do that. And I thank you, and would entertain
thank
any
you.
Questions.
I appreciate your testimony. Just a quick question from me. It would seem that, you know, knowing that all of the deposits that have the 220 insignia on there may not be exempt, that if that's the only thing you had to go on, you wouldn't be able to readily identify whether it was exempt or not. So I guess that's just... I guess I don't see a conflict there with the bill, actually. So I know you want to be able to definitely tell if it's exempt, or if the front-end person can't do it, then maybe they can flag it to go to the back-end person. If they can't do it, you know, it's not readily identifiable, I would guess, you know. I mean, can you just comment
on
that?
And Representative Chairholvey, you know, that's our question. You know, readily identifiable by what standards?
Mm-hmm.
Is it readily identifiable for the front office person completing the garnishment request, or does this require us to go beyond that measure? Typically, we wouldn't engage back office accounting staff to complete a garnishment.
Mm-hmm.
Again.
Yeah, I don't know that the bill requires you to do that, but I guess my point is that, you know, it wouldn't be perhaps readily identifiable at that point.
Right.
Maybe somebody else is. Anyway, not seeing any. Oh, Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a question. What exactly, I appreciate your testimony, but one thing I missed is what exactly you are asking for. Are you asking for a specific amendment, such as the A9? Are you asking for
the A10?
Or A10 in particular? Okay, thank you.
Yes. Chair Holvey, Representative Barton. Yes, we work with Representative Gillian to get the -A10 drafted. It came out 5 minutes prior to the hearing, and it's just proposed language as a starting point to discuss, you know, how we think that, you know, we can view some of these garnishments.
Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair. Well, I didn't have time, but that's okay.
I was waiting.
Oh, you're deferring your question to Representative Gilliam?
Certainly. Yeah, I'm sure it's a good one.
Representative Gilliam.
Representative Matthews, want to know when we're getting out of here.
probably not for quite a while.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to mention that I support this bill, obviously. I mean, these are folks that need to be protected, and so do the testifiers in front of us. I appreciate Senator Bonamici bringing it forward. I appreciate more that she got Senator Girard to actually do something productive. But she mentioned something in her testimony I think it's worth mentioning while these folks are up. She kind of said offhand, you know, we'd like to have the VA or some other federal agency take responsibility and help in this, but I'm paraphrasing. That's not going to happen. So, and I wish they would, but that's not our job. I want us to listen carefully to the folks we're asking to do this. Yesterday, in the Agriculture Committee, we were asking the Ag Department to change the way they were doing a certain refund for dollars, if you remember Representative Cowan. And, of course, they came back and said...
On that committee.
I meant the other guy. They came back and said, as a state agency...
Is this pertinent to the bill?
Yeah, it is. And they said, they pushed back and said, basically, this is going to be FTEs, this is going to be costs. And we backed off in our committee. The private sector is saying, we want to come to the table, we know how this is done, but we need some help. So I think this amendment, and maybe others, are pertinent. I think we can get the bill passed, but we ought to listen to the folks we're going to put the burden on who want to help us, assuming that these folks are going to be helped by this bill. And I think that's what these Dash 10s are about.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You know, but I just will comment that, you know, as Senator Bonamici pointed out, and as in containing the Dash 10, that this identifiable information of the payments is going to be transmitted to the institution with the payment, and you know, I think that's impossible from my standpoint. I don't think the state can pass a law that's going to require the U.S. Treasury or the Department of Veterans Administration to submit with a payment, whether or not it's exempt or not. I think that's really problematic.
Chair Holby, the Dash 10 amendment doesn't require anybody to do anything. We're just saying that the financial institution is able to identify it as exempt. I think there's a difference there.
But you're identifying it from information transmitted to the financial institution with the payment. So if it's coming from the federal government, you would assume that the information is coming from the federal government. And I just, from my standpoint, I don't know if that really works. Representative Riley.
I was not going to get into this, but I couldn't help myself. Having written applications in the NACHA area and DDA applications and so on for First Interstate, I'm fully aware that you can't always tell from the screen in front of you the exact place where that came from. You can tell it came from ACH and not ATM. And if not, it wasn't designed very well and you need to fix it. There's also the matter that we're talking about something that allows the your depositor to note actually identify those funds that are exceptions for you, and I believe that, you know, with those two things and the fact that you're not being held responsible if you make a mistake, should take care of it.
Thank you. Would you like?
Chair Holby, Representative Ryan, we appreciate those comments. I guess it's our goal, and I work with credit unions that are living and breathing these garnishments. They want to make this law so they feel comfortable complying with it, and that's why we're here today.
I understand.
Thank you. I do appreciate your testimony and
I appreciate your input into this whole process. Next up, I have Tim Martinez.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. I, too, want to thank Senator Bonamici for setting up this work group and letting the bankers be a part of it. As she mentioned very briefly, we did put our own proposal on the table, which lasted about a day, and then it was summarily dismissed, and we were part of the dismissees, so we understood why that didn't go forward. But one of the pieces that we are concerned about, and I guess I need to say that it is absolutely true that the bill passed out of committee and passed the floor without a no vote. I do think if you go back and check the Senate record, though, you will see some testimony that said we felt it needed some more work on the House, and we're going to try to do that over here. So that's why I think you see both the credit unions and the banks before you here today. Our issue is indeed the affidavit or the form in the bill. We certainly agree with the proponents of the bill that having this affidavit on file and having a list if they are indeed receiving some of these benefits would be helpful. Where we disagree is we think having this affidavit on file and being told that there are none of these funds in this account ought to be equally helpful as well. And it seems to be, I mean, we've had several conversations with the proponents of the bill before it passed the Senate on this issue. We did not oppose the bill, as I said. We wanted to get it over here and continue the dialogue. Again, it just seems to be an issue of fairness. I had potentially thought to draft two amendments. The ones we ultimately did were the dash nines, which simply removes the form from the bill. The second amendment I was had at least discussed, or my client has discussed introducing, which we didn't move forward, but which we would certainly be willing to consider, was making it clear in the bill that this form does work both ways, so that if you do take it and it does say it's there, you're good. If you do take it and it says there's no money there, you're good. We also would explain on the form that if this situation changes, that you will, just like you would notify the financial institution, if your address changed or your phone number changed or your name changed, any of those things, you would go into the financial institution and make those changes on your account. We also understand that in some cases you are talking disabled and folks that need extra help. We would suggest a lot of times that's why those folks have powers of attorney, so that people can come in and take care of that for them. So we are very supportive of the A9s. I thank Representative Gilliam for his comments. We have spent a lot of time, as have the credit unions, going through this matter. I know that the OBA has a bank operations committee that meets every month during the session. They've basically spent the last three meetings on this bill. Again, we think it's a great change. It is going to make it better for all parties concerned. But we have a lot of fear about leaving this form in here if it's not going to be acceptable both ways. And with that, I know you're short on time.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Cowan.
Thank you. I actually am struggling to understand what I just heard. So I'm going to take it from a personal perspective. To suggest a form that goes both ways, are you suggesting that if I have a bank account, I would have to file an affidavit that says if anybody decides they want to garnish something from my account, I don't have any funds that would be protected?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cowan, I think what the bill suggests is that if you came in after this bill were to become law and you opened up a new account, that the financial institution could say, you know, do you receive any of these funds? If you do, they would not be subject to garnishment, and we would like to know that rather than having to have the garnishment come in and then perhaps having you lose those funds, even on a temporary basis. So what the form is designed to do is say, yes, I get these funds, We also believe it should be designed to say, no, I do not get these funds, so that the institution is aware one way or the other. As the last folks that testified suggested, it's not necessarily as easy as it's been relayed to just look and see whether these funds, where they come from. I've had several discussions with bank operations folks, and it's not as simple as that one-page document would seem to suggest. What we're looking at is you get a garnishment in, it goes to the appropriate person within a bank in this case, they pull up the account information, and on the screen there is a line that says garnishable funds received. And if there's a yes check there, then it'll list there, and we'll comply with this bill very easily. If there's a no check there, we think we have complied with the bill at that point. Does that help?
I guess it answers my question. I don't expect to have my funds garnished ever, and I don't really expect to have to fill out a form about where my deposits come from, I guess. So it seems kind of a broad brush for anyone who opens a bank account. I guess that's where my concern is.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Cohen, then I would say yeah, support the Dash 9 side.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Gilliam.
Chair, I don't know if there's anybody in the room that can answer this, but if you just take the veterans example, if they're here to serve veterans, is there any point where they would send a check to a veteran in the state of Oregon when it would, for benefits, when it would not be exempt? And if so, why can't the Veterans Administration, at least in that case, signify on the check, note, exempt funds, or some other computerized code? I don't get that. Thanks.
Thank you for your comment. I don't get it either, but, you know, we don't run the federal government. So,
which, Mr. Chair, follow up, I agree we don't, but we were stuck with the problem, and now we're going to ask the private sector to help fix it. And government to government ought to communicate better than that, in my opinion.
ACH code will tell them where it came from.
So with that, Ms. Martinez, thanks for your testimony. I appreciate you letting us know where the bankers are. Next up, I have Jim Kotcher and Matt Wallace. And gentlemen, I am spent an incredible amount of time on my agenda on this bill. I appreciate that you know we don't have all the time in the world, but I do want to get your testimony in.
Thank you. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I'm Jim Kaur. I'm a staff attorney at Lane County Legal Aid, and since 1991, I've been an adjunct professor at the University of Oregon School of Law. Before Ron Wyden was a U.S. Senator, he was at one point a law student at the University of Oregon, and he helped our office establish a senior law program to provide free legal services to seniors. And during that program still is in existence, and during the past 2 years, we've seen an increasing number of people who have had Social Security and SSI benefits garnished from their bank accounts. And around the state, we know from talking with other attorneys and in our office, we've seen other people that have had their veterans benefits and their unemployment benefits garnished from their bank accounts. And these people need your help. Most people know that their benefits are supposed to be protected from garnishment, so they don't understand why the bank can give away their money without any notice to them. They don't understand why they have to go to court to get their benefits back. They don't understand why the court process takes so long. In cases I've seen, I'd say the average is 5 to 6 weeks. It's often 2 to 3 months and sometimes longer than that. They don't understand how they're supposed to pay their bills, pay their rent and their utilities, and buy food and medicine while they're waiting for the court to give them back their money. And they don't understand once they get their money back why they have to pay the bank garnishment fees and overdraft fees when the money should have never been taken in the first place. This money is supposed to be safe and protected, and we need your help to do that. It's very crucial that these benefits come every month, every single month. The challenge to garnishment procedure is not adequate to provide protection. You've heard from Senator Bonamici and Sybil Hebb about that. I'd just add that, as they've mentioned, a creditor can garnish a bank account even if it contains exempt funds, and the bank must pay those funds to the creditor under the current garnishment procedure. Many debtors don't file a challenge to garnishment. Some are cognitively impaired. Some think it won't do any good. They don't understand the instructions, which are quite complex. Or they may be overwhelmed by the economic crisis that they face when their bank account is wiped out. If they don't file a challenge to garnishment, the creditor keeps the exempt funds, even though they were garnished illegally. If they do file a challenge to garnishment, they eventually recover their funds. I know Mr. Marquis was here who represents the Debt Collectors Association in Oregon, and he knows, and his association members return funds when they have to. They have to return exempt funds. But as Ms. Hebb testifies, even doing that once it's in the court process takes weeks. And Mr. Marquis indicated that the collection agencies do not oppose this bill. We had a case with an elderly gentleman whose Social Security benefits were repeatedly garnished, and he tried to close his bank account to prevent additional garnishments, but he couldn't close his bank account because he couldn't afford to pay the bank fees that had accrued as a result of these garnishments. I watched another case where a frail elderly woman appeared before a judge to try to recover her Social Security benefits, which had been garnished, and she explained to the judge that her only income was Social Security. The judge told her that she needed to go out in the hallway and set up a payment plan with the creditor because that's the only way she could protect herself against further garnishments under the existing law. There's no way to stop these garnishments without enacting something like Senate Bill 731A. This bill would protect exempt benefits from garnishment. And I've attached to my testimony, I don't know if you all have it at this point, but I've attached a chart that shows how the protection would fit into the existing garnishment procedure. And when the bank receives a writ of garnishment, they would just determine if there was direct deposit of protected benefits in the preceding calendar month. And if the balance in the account was less than the protected amount, then there would be no garnishment, and the financial institution would charge no garnishment fees. And, of course, there would be no overdraft fees because the debtor's money would remain in their account and would cover the checks that they had written on the account. If the balance in the account was greater than the protected amount under this act, then the bank would pay the unprotected funds to the creditor. If there's no direct deposit of protected benefits, then the funds would be paid to the creditor just as they are now. From then on, the existing garnishment procedure would be unchanged. If funds were garnished, the debtor could file a challenge to garnishment. That would go through the court process, and the court would determine whether or not the funds were exempt. The bill does make a couple of changes, which I think Senator Bonamici mentioned briefly, which is through the court process, is that we're clarifying that commingling of funds, exempt funds with non-exempt funds, would not affect the exemption and not affect the exempt quality of these benefits. And we're also specifying that the courts will use the FIFO accounting method, first-in, first-out accounting method. Many states do specify an accounting method. There are different methods, and they result in different results. So we've specified that. Now, as I mentioned, the debtor could still file a challenge to garnishment. Representative Krieger mentioned, mentioned, for example, if there were past back benefits that had been accrued in the account and those are still garnished, the debtor would have to file a challenge to garnishment if the balance was more than the protected amount. And so that might happen if somebody had received a lump sum of benefits, for example, 2 or 3 months prior to the garnishment. Not all those benefits would be protected. We're looking at protecting the monthly amount of benefits, and so the debtor would have to file a challenge to recover
those. Can you maybe speak specifically
specifically to what's been brought up in the Dash 10 amendment about requiring, and I don't know if you've seen it, but requiring that the financial institution can identify it as being one of the types of payments described in subsection 2 of this section from information that's transmitted to the financial institution with the payment?
Right. Well, I oppose that for the reasons that Senator Bonamici gave, which is that we don't have any way to require people to the Veterans Administration or Social Security Administration to transmit any particular information. But as I've mentioned on page 3 of my testimony, there are 5 provisions of this bill, key provisions, to make this easy for financial institutions. And the first is only readily identifiable benefits are protected unless there's the form affidavit. But benefits have to be readily identifiable. And we know that other states, there are 5 other states that have enacted protection like this, and that's essentially the same term that they've used and that apparently workable in those states. We also know from looking at the bank account statements or financial institution statements that, and in the cases that we've seen, that often the benefits are clearly labeled. The deposits say, deposit $674 SSI or deposit $750 Social Security. So we know that the financial institution can identify those benefits, and it wouldn't make any sense to say, well, even though they're clearly labeled and even though they clearly know, since they weren't specifically identified in some fashion by Social Security Administration, that they wouldn't be protected. That just doesn't make any sense to me. The second key point, I guess, is that this form affidavit, which we think is critical, because not only will it make it easier for the financial institutions to apply the protection of the law, but it gives debtors a way to ensure that that their benefits will be protected. And thirdly, I want to mention again that banks are not subject to liability under this bill. We hope that the banks are perfect, or financial institutions are perfect, and that they will always protect the benefits, but we know that sometimes they may make mistakes, and if they do so in good faith, it's not the intent of this bill to subject them to liability.
Fourth, thank you. I think I'm going to have to move on. Representative Krieger, do you have a question?
One question. What would keep a person, a lot of these people get a Social Security benefit, a veterans benefit, to having it in 2 different banks and 2 different accounts?
Right.
They'd both be protected, wouldn't they?
That's right.
There'd be another way they can protect themselves.
That's right. And or if they get more than one kind of benefits in one account, again, the bill protects the total of all the benefits, because there certainly are people that get Social Security and SSI and public assistance.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you. Mr. Wallace.
Thank you, Chair Holley. For the record, Matt Wallace, consumer advocate with Osberg. I'm going to be so brief, I won't even spell out the acronym for you today. This bill is a simple step forward to fill essentially a procedural problem that exists now. Consumers have exempt funds. The exempt funds are being taken even though they're exempt, and the consumer has to go and go through a long and expensive and very stressful process to get those back. It doesn't change anything that's exempt, obviously. It just changed the procedure, and it's a pretty straightforward fix. The burden, especially in tough economic times, shouldn't be on the consumer to actually get those funds back. We should just make it so that the funds don't come out in the first place. So we strongly urge you to pass the bill as is. Thanks.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Thank you, committee. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 731 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 515A. Please give us a brief summary of Senate Bill 515A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 515A extends time period available for consumer remedy for vehicle that does not conform to manufacturer's warranty, grants manufacturer, manufacturer's agent, or authorized dealer at least 3 attempts to repair or correct during the early of a 2-year period after delivery of vehicle or the date the mileage reaches 24,000, or if motor vehicle is out of service at least 30 days, or motor home is out of service at least 60 days due to repair or correction. Grants manufacturer, agent, or authorized dealer of manufacturer at least 1 attempt to repair or correct nonconformity if nonconformity is likely to cause death or serious bodily injury. specifies calculations for reasonable allowance for use of motor vehicle, motorcycle, or motorhome by consumer when consumer returns them to the manufacturer, makes decision resulting from informal dispute settlement binding on manufacturer but not on consumer, allows award of attorney fees, expert witness fees, and cost prevailing consumer, allows award of attorney fees to manufacturer if court finds consumer brought the action in bad faith or for purposes of harassment, clarifies refundable charges and procedure for return of aftermarket item, requires manufacturer to request title inscription identifying vehicle subject to provisions of measure, requires disclosure of manufacturer buyback of non-conforming vehicle in future sale, lease, or transfer, makes failure to disclose an unlawful trade practice, grants director of the Department of Transportation rulemaking authority, defines collateral regard, defines collateral charge, declares an emergency effective on passage. This bill passed out of the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs 5-0 and passed the Senate 17-12-1.
Thank you. Up first, we have Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Chair Holvey and committee members. Suzanne Bonamici, Senate District 17. It's good to be back. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 515A today, and I really struggled with whether I wanted to start my speech with a string of rock songs that have car titles or car names in them. But then I decided instead to go with a Nobel Prize-winning economist, George Akerlof. And he wrote a paper called The Market for Lemons, Quality Uncertainty and the Market Mechanism. And he talked about something called information asymmetry. And that's when the seller has more knowledge about a product than the buyer. And granted, this was his study was about used cars, but it applies equally well to new cars. And how this difference of information between the seller and the buyer affects ultimately the price that the buyer is willing to pay. So you may wonder, why didn't I do the rock songs?
Thank you.
But what I wanted to do was talk about the issue of consumer confidence, and that Chair Holvey and committee members is what Senate Bill 515A is ultimately about. These are very difficult economic times, and I recognize that, as do we all. But now more than ever, if Oregonians, if our constituents, have the money that if they their hard-earned money and they want to use that to buy a car, whether it be a Mustang Sally or a little Deuce Coupe, it's critical that they have the assurance that the manufacturer will actually stand behind their purchase. So we want these automobiles to function at their highest level. It's often, as you know, one of the largest purchases that a consumer will make. And under most circumstances, their expectations are met, but every once in a while there'll be a defect that's so substantial that the car is considered a lemon. Oregon's had a lemon law for years. In fact, I found out recently that Chuck Bennett, when he was in the legislature, was one of the, he helped pass the very first lemon law for Oregon. But ours, Mr. Chair and committee members, is one of the weakest in the country. That's no offense to Chuck Bennett, because it was a long time ago that the bill was passed, but it really hasn't been updated. This bill, Senate Bill 515A, comes a long way to strengthen Oregon's lemon law and help to rebuild consumer confidence and stimulate the market for new automobiles. This is a result of a compromise process. As you know, Chair Holvey and committee members, most of the bills in our legislature come from that process. We had consumer advocates, car manufacturers, auto dealers, Department of Justice all come together and talk about basically every clause of the bill. I want to thank my legislative assistant, Emily Kinzer, who has worked tirelessly on this bill from the time we started until even this afternoon. The collaborative process resulted in the bill that's before you today. One of the things that I wanted to mention is that the recreational vehicle, the RV industry, has been around the table. They have been working for the past decade on a model lemon law that's specific to RVs, and we actually got access to that. We're the first state to have access to that. It was very lengthy. It's not really in a form that can be implemented at this point, but we will continue to work on this, and we have made changes to this bill, to 515, to address some of the concerns of the RV industry, but a separate lemon law for RV is not something we were able to accomplish
in this session. So here's what Senate Bill 515A does in a nutshell. There's a time period to discover that a car is a lemon. Oregon is has right now the shortest of several options. It has 12 months or 12,000 miles. So Senate Bill 515A, we join numerous other states in covering a time period of 24 months or 24,000 miles, whichever comes first. It also changes the number of times the consumer has to take the car in to repair the same problem. And remember, this has to be a substantial problem or it's not a lemon, from 4 times to 3 times. Again, several other states have that provision. Also, in the interest of safety, we'll join many other states. And also, this is in the model RV law, that if it's a defect that's likely to cause death or serious bodily injury, you don't have to keep taking the car back. You don't need multiple attempts for that particular type of defect. The bill also specifies what collateral charges can be reimbursed, and also defines a formula for reasonable allowance for use. These are two things that are in the current lemon law that aren't defined, so they're typically litigated and take time to resolve. This will help provide clarity, and the formula for reasonable allowance for use is basically a way to calculate. If there's a lemon, the consumer takes the lemon back, they don't get all their money back because they've been driving the car. So how do you determine what's the value of the time that they've been driving the car? And so that's what the reasonable allowance for use formula does. It just is a way to calculate how much they get back, because we know that they won't get the full purchase price back because they've been driving the car. One of the things that I wanted to point out was there's a provision that nobody from day one who saw this bill disputed, and that's a provision that says that if the lemon is taken back, the title needs to say that it's a lemon law buyback. Virtually every other state has that. We don't. So you could actually buy a car that was taken back as a lemon and not know that. So this bill requires that potential future buyers be advised that the car that they're purchasing was taken back as a lemon. Finally, if there is a lemon and the consumer does need to resort to litigation, I wanted to tell you that a lot of these are resolved without litigation or informal dispute resolution, but if they do end up having to go to litigation, this will allow attorney's fees to the manufacturer in situations where the consumers brought the case in bad faith or for harassment. I want to emphasize that the liability in lemon law cases is with the manufacturer. It's not dealer liability. The only exception in this particular bill is if there is a dealer that sells a lemon law buyback without the branded title, knowing that it's a lemon law buyback and they somehow conceal that, knowingly sell that, then there would be dealer liability. The rest of the liability is a manufacturer liability. And I want to close with a comment that I just saw a survey done by Accenture that shows that consumers are shopping for new cars, and as soon as they're out looking. And as soon as there's a thaw in the credit market, we expect and we hope that people will start buying. We want to assure that they're getting what they pay for with their hard-earned dollars. And when someone's stuck with a lemon, they can't get to work, they don't have the use of their car, they can't take their family where they need to go, and so it really does impede their ability to do what they need to do, especially if they have to keep taking their lemon back in to get it fixed. So please join me, Chair Holvey and committee, in supporting Senate Bill 515A, and I hope you'll send it to the floor with the due pass recommendation. And I did want to let you know, I did put the 2009 car complaint index on the back, just so I think probably Representative Gilliam has at least one of these cars, but I'm not sure. Of the top 2009 cars that people complained about, Land Rover LR2 is pretty high on the list, Mr. Chair. I don't think you have one of those, but I thought it was important for people to see that there are still cars that are problematic, and in these difficult times, it's even more important, Mr. Chair and committee, to protect our consumers. Representative Gilliam has a question.
Did you happen to see the -12 amendment to this bill?
I'm sorry, I did not. Mr. Chair, I heard that there was going to be an amendment.
Okay.
I know that there had been some discussion. Thank you very much. There has been some discussion, and maybe Emily can help me out. Is this?
is this the amendment you've been working on? Yeah, a thumbs up to the dash 12. This is the amendment that Emily's been working on. There is an adjustment to the collateral to the reasonable allowance to use that puts the collateral charge in, and a couple of other changes. Insert a comma.
I'm not going to ask you to make a snap judgment on the dash 12 at this point. So, any other questions?
Yes, this is an amendment that I do support, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing the bill forward. It's an honor to be on a bill with Representative Tomei.
That's right.
And this may be a little off subject, Mr. Chair, and if so, I can take it up with it later. But I am curious.
That would be a good idea.
Well, but I am curious. Are in your committee, because you have a counterpart in the Senate? When a member is late, do you mark him absent or excused? I just wondered what your policy was on that.
Mr.
Not
Chair,
germane to the bill,
yeah,
thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gilliam, people aren't late to my committee.
Oh.
Good answer. That is the right answer.
I'm off the bill.
And I'm trying to figure out how I can close with my pappy said, son, you're going to drive me to drinking if you don't stop driving that hot rod Lincoln, but I'm not sure that that's germane either, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I do encourage you to send this bill to the floor with the Representative. I can't leave yet. Representative Weiner has a...
Representative Weiner.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. And just a quick question, because I wasn't sure if Senator Mustang Bonamici had noticed this or not, but when we look at this, two of the companies that the government now owns are on this list. Why didn't we buy Ford? Because they're doing well, and they're not on this list. None of their cars are on your list. I think we bought the wrong companies.
Representative Weiner, you make a good point, and unfortunately, I don't think that's anything we can change here in the Senate. But the fact that I happen to be from Detroit may be relevant. I don't know. We used it. Ford was an acronym to us, Mr. Chair and Representative Weiner, for Fix or Repair Daily. So that's what it meant to us in Detroit.
Or found on road dead.
Or first on race day.
Anyway, thank you very much for your testimony today.
Thank you.
I appreciate
Chair
it. I'd like to have Craig Campbell come up, please. Let's do a... Mr. Chair. Give your short little introduction and how you're involved in this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of General Motors. We participated in the negotiations over on the House side. Obviously, with every bill, there's some things in here we like, some we don't, but we have put forward an amendment for you to consider, which is the Dash 812s that were recently discussed. Those amendments do two things. One is currently there's an affirmative defense in the bill for adjustments, variations that are made to the vehicle by the consumer, by the person who purchased the car. We want that expanded so that if those changes are made by chop shop dealer or somebody else, we have the ability to have an affirmative defense if those individuals make changes to the car that can be used to explain the deficiency that is being raised as a potential lemma mob problem. The second portion of the amendment, which is actually the line 1 through 14 on the amendments that are before you, changes the way that the reasonable allowance for consumer use of a motor vehicle means. Essentially what you're saying is right now when you as a dealer purchase back a vehicle, there's a certain amount that you pay. Under this bill, that amount is expanded by the collateral charges. But when you're negotiating or determining the amount that is deducted from that for the use of the vehicle while the consumer owned the vehicle, you don't use that same valuation. So what these amendments say is the amount that you are going to pay back is the same basis that you're using to determine the value of the use of the vehicle by the individual. It just brings it all into parity. And so that's what the Dash A12s do.
Thank you. I appreciate you bringing that up and bringing it forward. I don't see any questions for you. Appreciate your testimony, Mr.
Thank
Campbell.
You very much.
Matt Wallace and Danielle Bouvet. I don't know if I said that right, but
French, I am not.
French Canadian.
Thank you. Would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Oh, sure. Well, I'll go first. Again, for the record, Matt Wallace with Osberg. Again, I'll keep my testimony extremely brief. Senate Bill 515A is, again, a straightforward step forward to take Oregon's lemon law from one of the weakest in the country to, you know, just really catch up with our states, especially those neighboring us to the north, south, and east. Definitely, we support the provisions of the bill and are perfectly happy with the amendments in Dash 12As. And I'll just leave my spoken comments there. Strongly urge you to pass the bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, my name is Danielle Bove. I'm a consumer law attorney, also in favor of the bill. One thing that I want to clarify is that one thing that is not going to change is that the purpose of the lemon law is to help consumers who have a lemon, but it's very difficult to win under the lemon law with the bill as it is, with the statute as it is, and with the new bill. The lemon law requires that there be a substantial defect, which is defined as a substantial impairment to the use, the value, or the safety of the vehicle. So small problems don't count. The consumer is stuck with the, you know, with the hit on small and even medium problems. So it only applies to significant problems. In the past 10 years, I've practiced lemon law in 4 different states, so I feel that I'm in a good position to compare the Oregon lemon law with that of the other states, and I truly feel that it's one of the worst in the country. It's very restrictive. Even one of my regular opponents commonly says in his opening statement in court that it's very difficult to win under the lemon law. Most calls that I get where consumers have true lemons, I cannot use the lemon law because of its restriction. Now, there's two points that I'd like to make about the amendment. One is that one of the most restrictive aspects of the statute, the way it is that the consumer has to first complain about the problem within the first 12,000 miles or the first 12 months of the time the vehicle was first put in service. So if someone has, say, 4 engine problems, but the problem first starts at 12,300 miles, he's out of luck. He or she clearly has a lemon, but they cannot use the lemon law. So the current amendment wants to change that to 24,000 miles or 24 months from the initial time of service, which is more reasonable. Still restrictive, but more reasonable. Another problem with the lemon law, the way it is that it awards attorney's fees to the prevailing parties. Now, car manufacturers typically hire attorneys from big firms or very expensive attorneys. So if the consumer loses, he or she not only have to pay their own attorney's fees, but they have to pay the manufacturer's attorney's fees. So if the case drags out all the way to trial, the consumer could potentially be on the hook for more than the price of the car just in attorney's fees. That makes no sense. And I've read the lemon law of all 50 states, and I can honestly say that I'm not aware of any other states that have this provision. So the amendment would change that to an award of attorney's fees to the consumer if the consumer wins, which is, it's like that in many states, and which is more reasonable. Finally, I'm aware, of course, of the economic condition, but I would say that it's unreasonable that the consumer have to pay for the major problems to the vehicle. And, you know, the manufacturers need the consumer to survive, but, you know, the consumers, they need the legal protection. If they don't have that, then why would they want to buy a new vehicle, pay a high price, and with the danger of being stuck with the lemon and of paying high attorney's fees?
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. I don't see any questions for either of you.
Okay.
Next up, Paul Cosgrove.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, which is a trade association of most of the world's major auto manufacturers, and they're listed on the bottom of my testimony, both American, European, and Asian manufacturers. I'd also point out that a similarly named but different trade association, the International Automobile Manufacturers Association, which has some of the more unique brands and expensive brands, has also submitted a letter regarding their concerns about the bill. SB 515 is being described to you as a much-needed modernization of our lemon law, and one that has been described as one of the weakest in the nation. And I would just like to take issue with that conclusion. And one example, and it's one of the concerns we have with the bill, which is doubling the time within which to make the initial lemon law complaint from 12 months, 12,000 miles, to 24 months, 24,000 miles. There's a state-by-state analysis of new car lemon laws that we used and discussed as part of the work group. And just alphabetically, I'll say that the states are at 12, 12, 24, 24, 18, 12, 24. Is it the mode, which means more of them are at that number than anybody else? Thank you, Representative Bart. The mode, in fact, of all states is 12,000 miles. There are states that are at 18. There's one state at 15,000, and there's several states at 24,000. But I think that one of the important reasons that we find this troublesome is one of the world's and Oregon's largest car manufacturers, the manufacturer that sells frequently sold cars manufactured cars in Oregon, had a total of 39 complaints in all of last year under Oregon's lemon law. 38 of them were settled by discussions, not even the process of arbitration that's required under the lemon law. Oregon has an arbitration process, as do most states in their lemon laws. The other one did go to arbitration, which is not binding on the consumer under current law. It is binding on the manufacturer. The manufacturer won, and the consumer accepted that result. So I think what we're doing here is doing an awful lot of changes to our lemon law that served us quite well on the assumption that it needs to be improved without much showing that, in fact, it isn't working really quite well right now. And the concern we have is that extension of the time to make the initial complaint, doubling it, as well as changing the attorney's fees provision, effectively dramatically increases the liability for manufacturers, and we're concerned about that. There are five changes that I mentioned on my testimony of concern to us. There are others that we discussed and were willing to agree to. One is the change from 12 to 24 that I just mentioned. One is the reduction in the number of repair attempts allowed before the car is declared a lemon from 4, which is the current number and a common number in other lemon laws across the country, to 3. The third one is the detailed written records. That would be resolved if you pass the Dash 11s. The fourth one, and this one is of particular concern as well because it doesn't really make much sense to us. The bill requires us, if a car is declared a lemon, that we must pay back at least a pro rata share of aftermarket parts installed by the consumer, including those things that, in fact, have violated the warranty. And these are not things that are purchased at the dealer as part of the sale. These are things that within at least the first 20 days, that's the limit under the proposed amendment, someone goes to another place and gets a car tricked out. It could be, as I say, something that violates the warranty. And if that is then declared a lemon, we need to pay for that extra work, and we think that's unfair. And then the final one, which I mentioned, is the change to the current even-handed method of allocating attorney's fees to one that is not even-handed. Recall that under Oregon's lemon law, it only comes into play when people haven't been able to discuss it and resolve it, which, as I just mentioned, happens almost all the time. And then litigation only occurs after you've gone through an arbitration process, which doesn't involve attorneys, and the consumer has lost and effectively appeals that arbitration to court. And under that scenario, which is effectively close to a third bite of the apple, we think it is fair to have whichever party loses in court pay the other party's reasonable attorney's fees as determined by the court using all the normal factors. I just finished by mentioning it's clear you can pick up the paper almost any day or any week and see the concerns and problems of the auto industry. It's clear the auto manufacturers are in great stress, so are auto dealers who are our agents in selling these products to the consumers, and the people who deal with these complaints at first blush, the people They'll come back to Detroit or to Tokyo or to Stuttgart with their lemon law problems. They come to our dealers, and they are also having extraordinary problems as well. And we would ask you to not favor this bill at this time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Cosgrove, how do you feel about some of the dealerships that install these aftermarket parts at time of purchase?
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, if a dealer installs at times of purchase, it is something we would be paying for if the car turns out to be 11. The only things that we are of concern are the things that are installed by a private shop, not the dealer, after purchase. So it's not the extras that you buy at purchase that we're concerned with. That's fine. That's appropriately to be reimbursed to the consumer if the car is declared at 11.
And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
And I guess my point would be that most of the time these people buy these cars thinking they're going to own them a while, so they make the investment to, whether it's wheels or grills or stereos or whatever it is, they put those investments into the car, assuming they'll have it a while. Those are protected under insurance. I don't know why it wouldn't be protected under this law.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Matthews, the owner has the right to remove those items, and in some cases that would be appropriate. I agree that in some cases it would be installed in such a way that it isn't a practical resolution, but to the extent they can be removed, certainly the consumer is allowed to keep those if the car is declared a lemon and then they get paid for the value of the car that they purchased.
Thank you. Representative Wingard.
Well, I want to stay on that for a second. So assume someone buys a car that is a lemon, they don't know it yet, and they spend a couple of $1,000s to do some aftermarket work on their car, which they, as Representative Matthews said, they may be thinking it's worth a couple of grand because I'm going to own this car for 10 years or 8 years or something. Within a year, it's clear the car is a lemon, and they go back to the dealer, and they want the dealer to take that back. Is it your client's position that they should have to eat the cost that they invested into that car, and they will now be given a new car? You know, they're getting a new car in trade or what have you, and they've got to go out and redo that all again at their own expense when they were sold a defective product?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winger, the current law is that that's what happens. That is the majority view, if not the exclusive view, of other lemon laws across the country. And it is because this is a very special consumer remedy that's beyond all the normal warranties. And because it's a special remedy, it's somewhat limited and somewhat different than other kinds of remedies. And this would be a significant change in Oregon and a significant increase in costs for manufacturers. But that is the current law, and in fact, the law of most, if not all, other states on that issue. Not, and just to clarify again, not with respect to anything that's done at the time of purchase. If the dealer undercoats the car, if the dealer puts in special leather seats, if the dealer puts in the new car's radios or all of those, or the new wheels, that's all covered in the formulation that is applied when it becomes a lemon. When it becomes a lemon, there's a formula that's applied based on mileage, and we're talking about what goes into that formula. And what we're proposing, the bill proposes to add all of those aftermarket parts in if they're purchased within the first 20 days. Ironically, not if they're after that, just the first 20 days worth of them go into the formula. We're proposing they stay out of the formula.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I'm not sure I got an answer to my question. Is it your client's position that a person who has made that investment doesn't deserve to be compensated by the manufacturers for the fact that they made that investment in their car and now will have to make it again in the next car that they will get?
Mr. Chair, Representative, if we were talking about limiting the aftermarket parts to those that things that didn't violate our warranties, I think you've got a fair comment. But right now, even things that would violate our warranties would be reimbursable, and that's the specific concern we have.
Thank you.
Sure. Representative Krieger.
I buy your car brand new. I got some money, so I put a $20,000 paint job on it.
I'm sorry?
Brand new. And I put a $20,000 paint job, specialty paint job. Never take it home. Take it right from the dealer. Have $20,000 put onto it. 2 months later, guess what? We've got a lemon. I can't take that paint job with me.
Representative Krieger, Ms. Chairman, Representative Krieger, you're correct. If the paint job, and all of these decisions on what gets reimbursed and what doesn't get reimbursed have some bad results in particular cases. So starting with that, I can't defend that particular case, but if you'd had it done at the dealer, it would be under current law, and most states' laws, reimbursable. It's when it's left our dealer that we have an issue, and in particular with respect to things that violate warranty, and obviously the paint shop would not.
Thank you. I really need to move on, and I appreciate your testimony. I think you've given a pretty clear position, and
thank you.
I know manufacturers are under stress and dealers are under stress due to economic conditions, but so are consumers, and this is an interesting bill, to say the least. I appreciate your testimony. I have one more signed up. Keith Domenovich, please.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is Keith Dubanovich. I'm special counsel for the Attorney General. While the Department of Justice does not presently have any jurisdiction over Lemon Law complaints, we received in 2007 19 written Lemon Law complaints and 16 in 2008. Based upon data from the federal government, the average price of a new car in America is $28,400. And for at least the average Oregonian, it is probably the second largest expense that they incur in their lifetime. So it is a potentially substantial financial impact on consumers. We are here in part because we were asked to invite to participate in the work session. As has already been testified, the work session was frankly a very good work session, multiple work sessions. There was a lot of give and take between representatives of the industry and advocates. The primary aspects of this bill that we believe, frankly, merit its being passed are indeed the expansion of the time frame from 2 years. So from 1 year and 12,000 miles to 2 years and 24,000. And let me give you an example of one of the complaints that we've received, and that is a woman who obtained a vehicle. She probably bought it at this time of year when it doesn't rain much during the summer. And by the time she had 12,000 miles on it, it started to rain, and she started to have leaks. But because the car had already 12,000 miles on it, it couldn't be returned as a lemon. Well, nonetheless, she attempted to get it repaired on a number of occasions. It hasn't been able to be fixed, and now she has mold growing in her car. And because of that, her kids are getting sick. But she's stuck with a vehicle that cost her more than $20,000, and she can't take it back. If the bill as proposed was in effect, she would be able to return that car as a lemon. The other major aspect of this bill that we think is extremely helpful is the branding of the title. As Senator Bonamici has described, at the present time, a lot of other states brand a vehicle that is returned to the dealer as a lemon. So if you buy the vehicle as a used car, you'd know in New Mexico, for example, that it was returned as a lemon. However, if you today buy a car in Oregon that's returned as a lemon, you won't know that it's actually a lemon, and hence you might be paying Blue Book value for a vehicle that's a lemon. And worse yet, vehicles are returned in other states such as New Mexico, branded in New Mexico as a lemon, but then brought to Oregon where they're retitled and that brand disappears. So Oregon consumers are frankly at a disadvantage in comparison to our neighboring states. One additional aspect, which is what brought the Department of Justice to the table, and that is that it gives us enforcement authority over those companies that fail to brand a title as a lemon. And the rationale, obviously, is that that has a substantial impact on consumers, and therefore it is, under this bill, a violation of our Unlawful Trade Practices Act. This bill has no fiscal impact on the Department of Justice, and at least from the discussions that we had in the work session, it should have no or minimal impact on Oregon businesses because A lemon issue is a manufacturing issue. It is not a dealer issue. Indeed, the dealers are oftentimes stuck in the middle between the manufacturer and the consumer. The dealer wants to satisfy the consumer, but they can't because there's a manufacturing defect. So this probably will have no impact on Oregon dealers. Last but not least, there was some discussion about aftermarket items. Items that are installed in a vehicle after the consumer purchases it from a third party that in any way violate or modify or are contrary to the warranty, those kind of items can be raised as an affirmative defense by the manufacturer in any dispute with the consumer about whether it's a lemon or not. So, for example, if I buy a vehicle and have a roof rack drilled into the roof and then the car starts leaking water, the manufacturer would have a right to raise as an affirmative defense the material modification to the vehicle that modified or violated the warranty. So I know you are short on time. I will end my comments there, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, you won't receive any authority under this bill, I take it.
Not any additional authority. I'm sorry, Chair Hulvey, Representative Gilliam. The only additional authority we get is if a title is not branded. In that situation, we would have the ability to enforce a violation of the UTPA against the company that failed to brand the title. That's all the additional authority we get.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
You get the complaints because folks don't know where to turn. What do we usually, what's the proper way, or do you divert them to another agency?
Chair Hulvey, Representative Gilliam, there is no other agency that has any jurisdiction over lemon laws because no one has any regulatory authority over it. I guess theoretically you could refer to the Department of Transportation, but I'm not sure they would do anything either.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm not seeing any other questions for you. I appreciate your testimony. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 515 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 952A. Victoria, can you give us a quick description of the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 952A strengthens the rights of tenants living in property subject to foreclosure sale, includes provisions to require that tenants receive advance notice of foreclosure proceedings with specific information for tenants, allows tenants with fixed-term leases to stay after the foreclosure sale for the earlier of 60 days or until the lease expires, except when the purchaser intends to live on the property, in which case only 30 days notice is required, provide tenants with weekly or monthly agreements, 30 days notice after the sale of the intention to evict, allow tenants receiving notice of foreclosure to apply prepaid security deposits towards ongoing rent obligations and relieves purchaser of any obligations to return security deposits, and clarify the purchasers do not become landlords unless they accept rent from the tenant, enter into a new rental agreement, or fail to terminate the tenancy as provided by this bill. This bill passed the Senate Judiciary Committee 410, passed the Senate 2541, and has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Thank you. Senator Bonamici is up first, and I'm trying to get through the bills that you're here to testify on.
Thank you. I appreciate
that. And it has taken a little bit longer than I thought.
Thank you, Chair Hulvey. I've enjoyed spending the time with you. My name is Suzanne Bonamici, and I represent Senate District 17, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 952A. Chair Hulvey and committee, we had several informational hearings in the Senate Consumer Protection Committee about foreclosure and how foreclosure affects homeowners, but this particular aspect addressed in Senate Bill 952A is how foreclosure affects tenants. And many properties are occupied by tenants. Often those are families with children. The tenants are really, truly, Mr. Chair, the innocent parties in these foreclosures. The National Low-Income Housing Coalition estimated that nationally about 40% of property in foreclosure is tenant-occupied. We happen to know that this is a growing trend in Oregon. We've heard stories from press in
the major metropolitan areas, but we've also started to hear from other areas as well. Current Oregon law provides little protection for renters in foreclosure. In fact, that tenants with a lease find that their lease is completely extinguished. And there's also a serious timing issue because someone who hopes to purchase a home at foreclosure sale can actually give an eviction notice before the sale goes through. So then the renter's not sure, what do I do? Where do I pay? Who do I pay my rent to? And what are my responsibilities? And sometimes the tenants find themselves scrambling to try to find money to find another place. They have to try to scrape up money for another deposit. So they're very uncertain about what to do. And on top of this, they may be forced to move even if the foreclosure is avoided by a workout. They feel like they've got to move because they've already found another place. They often don't get their security deposits back if there's a foreclosure, making it even more difficult for them to relocate. So what happens with Senate Bill 952A? There's a solution. First, there's a notice that goes to the tenants in foreclosure, and that gives them advance notice that will give them information about their rights and where they can go for assistance. Senate Bill 952, secondly, modifies the procedure and the timing. As I explained, under the current system, the prospective purchaser can give notice of the foreclosure. This says only the owner of the property can provide an eviction notice. So once the sale goes through, then an eviction can start, but not before. Third, Senate Bill 952 sets out these timelines. Tenants who have a fixed-term lease can stay after the foreclosure sale until the lease expires or for up to 60 days, whichever is shorter. We don't know how many tenants in Oregon have long-term leases. We expect that most of them have month-to-month. For the tenants who have month-to-month or any other rental agreement, they can stay up to 30 days. And fourth, the Senate Bill 952A has a security deposit protection where if there's a notice of foreclosure, then the tenant can request that their security deposit be applied to rent, so that they can save money to get a place somewhere else. And finally, Senate Bill 952A protects the purchaser in several ways. It only protects residential tenants in legitimate good faith rental agreements. It provides that the tenants have to show that they're entitled to these protections by providing proof that they have a rental agreement before the foreclosure sale. Purchasers are also released from liability for any pre-existing issue or security deposit, so they won't have to pay the security deposit that another landlord got. And finally, the purchaser does not need to become a landlord unless they accept rent. They don't have to sign another rental agreement unless they don't terminate the tenancy. Contrast that with current law. Under current law, the purchaser can't charge rent for 10 days. So the tenant is allowed to stay for 10 days after the foreclosure, but then they have to move. So this just gives an extra 20 days for most tenants. It allows the purchaser to charge rent if that's their choice. If they do not charge rent, they don't have the responsibilities of a landlord. If they do, they have the responsibilities of the landlord. It's a balance. Many large lenders, including Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, have already implemented policies to prevent eviction of tenants. And I also want to explain that several other states have passed similar legislation, although, Chair Holvey and committee, it's my understanding that most of the states have protections that are greater than these. Many of them actually honor the entire lease. This bill, 952A, only allows up to 60 days with a long-term lease or 30 days otherwise. In the Senate, we have letters of support from the Housing Alliance, the City of Bedford, Jackson County, Oregon Action, the Oregon Law Center, Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center. Mr. Chair and committee, I strongly urge you to send Senate Bill 952A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. As we know, foreclosure is devastating. It's especially important to protect some rights of tenants who are truly the innocent parties. And one final point I want to make, Chair Holvey and committee members, is that I don't know the percentage of these homes that are being taken back by the financial institutions, but it is in their interest to have somebody occupying the home. If the home is sitting empty, it's more subject to vandalism. So it's helpful to have somebody there in the home taking care of it, and it does give the tenant more time to find another place if they need to, if the foreclosure goes through. So thank you so much, Chair Holvey, for having a hearing on this important bill, and I do hope that you will move it forward. And I'm happy to answer questions, but I know that There are people here with certainly more technical expertise than I have who could answer them for you.
I just have one question for you, and that is the Dash 5 amendment. Have you had a chance to review that?
Sorry, I have not. I'm sorry.
All
but,
right.
I know Sybil's here, and she can.
Yeah, no, she's up next, so we'll bring.
All right. Thank you again, Chair Holby, for hearing this important.
Thank you very much. I'm going to have Sybil Hebb, John Van Landingham, and Janet Bird.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center in support of Senate Bill 952A, and we are supportive of the Dash 5 amendments. I echo the comments that Senator Bonamici has made. She's eloquently summarized the provisions of the bill. I have a few pieces to add. From the Law Center's perspective, of course, we have offices across the state. We hear from low-income tenants with increasing rates related to what their rights are and how they can proceed when their homes are being foreclosed on. What happens is they will get wind somehow that the house is in foreclosure. They will call the landlord and ask for clarification. Frequently, the response that they get is reassuring, don't worry, it's not a problem, I'm going to get this taken care of, and then suddenly they find themselves without a lease protection as the foreclosure does in fact move forward. And so we are very supportive of the provisions of Senate Bill 952. We think they provide some reasonable and very important protections, basic protections, for a vulnerable category of folks who really have been left out of this discussion nationwide and in Oregon until now. So we appreciate the attention to the issue. I would say that with respect to the issue of foreclosure, tenants are even more vulnerable than our homeowners. We have folks who are being forced to try to find new homes with very little notice. Generally, they have families. Generally, they have children, jobs. Juggling all of those responsibilities with very little notice to try to find a new place can very often really result in homelessness. And so the fact that the burden for the tenant is so great and that they are so vulnerable makes this sort of an especially important issue, especially at this time. The other point that I would make is that the problem of tenants being evicted with little notice as a result of foreclosure is not only a problem for families, it's also a problem for neighborhoods. What we have is people being evicted and homes sitting vacant. And when homes sit vacant, they are not maintained. There is less security. They're subject to vandalism. And we have seen across the state neighborhoods' property values deteriorating as a result of this. We've also seen crime coming to the vacant homes. There was recently an article in the paper about a small town in the small town of LC, where a landlord lost a number of homes in that community, and they were sitting vacant, and there were troops of people targeting those homes to go and strip them of their fixtures and try to sell them somehow. So it's not something that neighborhoods and neighbors want to have going on around them. So it's a family issue. It's also a neighborhood issue. Senator Bonamici did a great job of describing the current problems under our law, where by now, even though you're a legitimate tenant paying your rent on time, you can still be out with very little notice, and that just doesn't seem right. So the bill as before you in the A's is summarized in a document that that has just been passed out. There are also amendments that are pending in the Dash 5 amendments. Those were negotiated in conversations with industry, with the United Financial Lobby, and if those there's one additional tweak that we need that John Van Landingham can give you some more information about, but we will have to do one small change, but we expect to get that done very quickly, and we expect to be able to bring it back on Friday, but with the neutrality of the Unified Financial Lobby, and so we think think that's a good benefit, and it's a reasonable proposal. So we will work hard with their assistance to get that done very quickly. I can briefly summarize the amendments for you. I think those just add a few pieces to the protections that Senator Bonamici described. Number one, the lenders asked for a delay in the implementation date of the bill and the effective date of the bill to give them time to reach out and provide education to their members about the changes in the law. We thought that was reasonable, so that will be addressed in the Dash 5 amendments. Another provision of the amendments is that the bill, as Senator Bonamici describes, provides purchasers with a choice. After the foreclosure sale is complete, they can accept rent and become a landlord, or they can choose not to become a landlord, and therefore they wouldn't be accepting rent. In that case, though, they need to have a means by which they can evict people who have behaved badly for one reason or another. And so we have an amendment that will make sure that purchasers, even if they are not landlords, may act pursuant to the Landlord-Tenant Act for purposes of evicting people who have behaved with outrageous conduct. So that's another amendment. The other piece is that the bill provides protection only for people who are in good faith tenancies. These are legitimate tenants that we are providing protection for. And the bill, the amendments will provide a presumption that a tenancy created after the service of a foreclosure sale notice is presumed not to be in good faith, and that a long-term tenancy entered after the service of that notice is not in good faith. And so those are protections that were provided as a result of negotiations with the lender lobby. We did also provide an amendment that puts a small change into the notice that will go out to tenants that provides them information that they may, under federal law, have greater notice rights. Federal law recently passed that provided certain greater notice for certain tenants in certain types of properties, and so we didn't want our provision to be inconsistent with that. There's one remaining tweak that will just clarify when a purchaser has liability after the foreclosure sale, and we will get that language resolved. There are 10 other states that have similar provisions. There is also legislation pending in 13 other states. So this is something that is an issue across the nation, and states are taking steps to address. There's one.
Thank you, Sybil. I really need to move on.
Thank
with
you very much.
I appreciate your thorough review, but it appears to me that we have yet another amendment coming to this bill. So I'm going to go ahead and take the rest of the public hearing testimony at this time.
John Van Lanningham, Lane County Legal Aid. 2 points. I'm Sybil's assistant and support the bill. Secondly, I'm here to answer any questions on landlord-tenant law. That's my designated role, including what the negotiated new amendment in the hallway was half an hour ago.
Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chair Hulvey, members of the committee, my name is Janet Bird, and I'm the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships, and I'm here today on behalf of the Housing Alliance. I've submitted a written statement, and I won't read it all to you. I will call your attention to the letterhead of the Housing Alliance. We are a coalition of 67 members statewide concerned about the problem of housing access, homelessness, and affordable housing statewide. Because of our concern with the housing market and its inability to provide homes for everyone, we're really excited about this bill, Senate Bill 952. We're particularly supportive of the notice provisions in a market such as we have, where it's becoming harder and harder for particularly lower-income tenants to find housing to rent. We think it's especially important that tenants receive as much notice as possible of an impending foreclosure. Moving, as you all remember, I personally try to avoid moving as much as possible, but requires a great deal of planning. If you have kids in school, you need to look at relocating kids. And it requires a great deal of effort for low-income tenants to accumulate the money required for a security deposit, first and last month's rent, and moving expenses. For that reason, we also are particularly supportive of the provisions in 952A that allow tenants to apply existing rent and security deposits to rent payments. we feel that this gives people an extra little bit of opportunity to accumulate the money that they need to make a move and prevent homelessness. We believe the bill represents a fair balance between the needs of low-income tenants and the concerns that are raised by owners and lenders, and we appreciate the work that Senator Bonamici and other advocates have done on the bill to come to this balanced approach. Thank you for your attention and your time.
Thank you, and I have one question for Mr. Van Landingham. Do you have any knowledge whether this forthcoming amendment will replace the Dash 5 amendment or be in addition to it?
Mr. Chair, I don't. I would hope that it would be inclusive. That's LC, I think, makes that choice, not us.
Okay. No further questions. I appreciate all the testimony today on this bill. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 952 and open a work session on Senate Bill 203A. I think it's 203A, isn't it? Uh-oh. Committee, I'm not opening a work session on Senate Bill 203A. I'm going to stand at ease.
Terrible.
I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill reconvening and opening a work session on Senate Bill 203A. Thank you. Can we get Craig Smith to come up, please? Victoria, can you review the bill and the Dash 4 amendment, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 203A makes Oregon lien law consistent with the Construction Contractors Board statute by establishing the same threshold requirement of $2,000 for a written contract, providing the information notice to owner about construction liens, increases renewal period for an expired license, and authorizes CCB to sanction exempt independent contractors who hire employees. Deletes requirement that written residential contracts contain a summary of notices and eliminates contradictory language. The Dash 4 amendments change that to require the contract to contain a list of required notice, which replaces the summaries previously required. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, I appreciate you coming forward to identify yourself for the record.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Craig Smith. I'm with the Construction Contractors Board.
Thank you. I just had a couple of things that I may want you to comment on, and maybe the committee has questions for you. I believe this bill, we discussed some other amendments to this bill, and I believe we, as a committee or as a chair, I dropped those amendments after listening to some of the testimony. But this particular amendment was a concern that was brought forward with by Representative Riley that I thought actually had some good merit. And I know what was currently being done was the CCB was providing a summary of those notices and seemed very duplicative of the notices themselves. And we thought it, though important not to, in abandoning that summary, that it still be important to provide just a list so the consumer has somewhat of a checklist of what notices he's supposed to have in a contract. Can you just review, is this going to be a problem for the CCB? And we obviously have no fiscal impact to it, but and whether you have a position on this or not.
Chair Holley, members of the committee, I think that this amendment would be an improvement to the current law. I think I can represent that although we haven't run it by the board, that I think that I can't see a lot of opposition on board members, and it makes sense to me.
Mr. Chair, which amendment are we discussing?
It's a dash 4 amendment, I believe. Is that correct?
Okay. Sorry, trying to keep up here.
Yeah, it's tough to keep up sometimes.
Yes, it is.
Representative Barton. Computerized. You're back.
Yes, sir.
So with that,
Mr. Chair, I move the A4 amendments to Senate Bill 203.
Representative Riley moves the dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 203A discussion. Not seeing any. Cindy, can we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Callan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Dash 4 amendments are adopted to Senate Bill 203A.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Weird.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the A3 amendments to Senate Bill 203.
You would? Representative Wingard has moved the A3 amendments to Senate Bill 203. Discussion?
Let me find them.
Victoria, can you summarize for the committee the dash three? I don't know. Go ahead, then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The dash 3 amendments were discussed Monday. They allow residential contractors to work on commercial structures if the value of the work is less than $100,000, similar to legislation previously discussed, House Bill 2519, with the amount changed from $250,000 to $100,000.
It is not the intent of the chair to move the dash 3 amendments, but they have been moved, and I feel compelled to give it a vote. So with that, Cindy, can we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton?
No.
Representative Callan?
No.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Discussion?
Representative Krieger?
Representative Krieger, would you like to make a comment before your vote?
Well, I haven't really had time to read the dash threes. I don't know who brought them forward. Just boom, there they are, and we make these type of decisions real quick. I'm real uncomfortable.
We discussed them at length at our last meeting.
Mm-hmm. I don't recall.
No, they were similar to an amendment.
Changed the numbers on the dollars or what they can work with.
It related to the... I'll interrupt. I'd like to suspend the rules just so we can have this discussion. I don't know if it's necessary, but I'd like to suspend the rules. Is there any objection to that, to discuss this for Representative Krieger? Mr. Smith, can you describe the dash 3 amendment just real briefly for us so we don't have lay people up here? It had to do with the licensing and bonding amounts and the scope of work for residential and commercial contractors.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, I don't have that dash amendment with me right now, and I can tell you that I believe the person who had them prepared is in the room. Perhaps you'd rather have him.
I'll have the committee administrator go over that at this time.
Mr. Chair, I might be able to add shed a little light on this, I believe, in knowing the dash threes, although I don't have them in front of me, if you will grant me that opportunity.
Do you have the dash threes in front of you?
Here.
Okay.
We had a previous bill, whether it be in this committee or I believe in this committee, and we had discussions surrounding permit and licensing for commercial contractors and residential contractors. And this, and if you'll recall, as we back up, being a firefighter, I voiced my concerns with having anybody doing any kind of structural repairs, residential contractors in commercial buildings. And this was initially sold to me as somebody working on doorknobs and those things. And I took great concern with what we're going to be doing to damage the integrity of a structure by allowing residential contractors. I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. Having said that, I believe that then it was, and I'll say Mr. Kafouri, that it had this amendment drafted to still try to get his folks in a building to do some non-structural related repairs as residence contractors. Given what it is, I can tell you that the industry has come out a little bit against us, but I don't believe they ever thought this resurfaced again. So I don't know that a lot of the contractors even know this is coming. With that, I'm not real comfortable, particularly being somebody that would support this amendment today. However, I can appreciate the work Ms. Kafouri went into it, understanding that we are talking about a 10x10 as the example, cigarette-type storage facility in a Costco, just to put it in perspective, that wouldn't go to the roof but just an 8-foot wall versus anything else. We're talking about dollar amounts here, pretty significant for structural impact, and therefore I won't be supporting that amendment today, but the concept itself, I think, is somewhat has merit.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that, and we had a lot of discussion about this last session, and again this session in a different bill, and there was not consensus between the different stakeholders from the different construction industries on this issue, and the AGC for one testified against this bill, and the mechanical contractors, and sheet metal contractors and several others. And so, this was a bill that was passed last session and it came out of this committee, and until there's some sort of agreement to change that, which there hasn't been, I'm not comfortable with the amendment. So, Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to, now that I've already had the opportunity to vote, I would like to explain that vote. I indeed give Mr. Kafouri the note to prepare the dash 3 amendments. I've discussed these amendments several times, both with the chair, with the proponents, and with the opponents. And again, I echo perhaps Representative Matthews' sentiments such that I think this is a legitimate discussion to have. However, the means in which it's been moved and the motion is made before us, I view this, frankly, as more akin to, perhaps analogous to a procedural motion done on the floor. And my vote is very much in support of the chair, who has been very clear to me on several times that he does not intend to move this. And my vote, I think, I want to be construed more as support of the chair in this committee than necessarily a substantive position.
Thank you. And I would like to return to Representative Krieger.
Thank you for taking time for this. I do understand it, and I do remember it, and it's a turf deal. And I'm not right now because the way it's come forward, but from further explanation before in committee, I would not support the amendment.
Thank you. And with that, I'd like to return to the roll call vote, please.
Representative Krieger?
No.
Representative Matthews?
No.
Representative Kamei?
No.
Representative Winger?
Yes.
Vice Chair Widener?
Yes.
Vice Chair Riley?
No.
Chair Holby?
No. The dash 3 amendment, having not received the votes, is failed. Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 203A as amended to the floor and do pass recommendation.
Representative Riley moves Senate Bill 203A as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion? Hearing none. Cindy, could we have a roll call vote?
Representative Martin?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 203A, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor with due pass recommendation. Carrier on the bill. I'll carry the bill then. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 203A. And committee, I have expired my time. I apologize that I didn't get to another bill I was going to move today. But with that, committee, I'm going to carry over Senate Bill 929A. I am going to open a work session on Senate Bill 973A, and I am going to close the work session on Senate Bill 973A. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 731A and close the work session on Senate Bill 731A. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 515A and close the work session on Senate Bill 515A. Open a work session on 952A and close the work session on 952A. In committee, I'll be carrying over the work session on Senate Bill 973A, the work session on Senate Bill 731A, and the work session on 515A, and the work session on 952A until Friday. With that committee, I will adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.
We could have kept going.